American Nuns versus the Catholic Church.
I mean, Christ was very political.
Whatever your beliefs, the stunning developments this year that led to a Vatican reprimand of America's nuns points to a fascinating examination of women's role in the church and society. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. This spring, America's nuns were reprimanded after a Vatican investigation, told they were too political, too feminist, disobedient to the bishops under whom they serve, and a bishop has been appointed to take a firmer grip on the reins. It follows the nuns' outspoken support of health care reform when the bishops came out against it, but it's been brewing ever since Vatican II reformed many of the stricter regulations for Catholic women religious. The Vatican is concerned that this revolution in the lives of American nuns will spread across the world. Emma Weatherall of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies spoke with nuns as they waited for the Vatican's verdict.
Joanne Roy is cooking dinner for the women that she lives with.
The turkey's ready. Okay.
Joanne is under investigation, as are two of the women that she lives with, and 60,000 other women across America. Joanne is also known as Sister Joanne Roy. She's a Catholic nun. For the past 2 years, American nuns have been subject to a $1 million investigation by the Vatican.
We kind of felt this is interesting. You know, there's a whole issue with sexual abuse with priests, and we're getting the investigation, you know.
In 2009, Cardinal Rode was the official in charge of religious orders across the world. In an interview on Vatican Radio, he warned against American nuns having a secularist mentality and a feminist spirit. This concern caused an apostolic visitation into American religious women. An apostolic visitation is a pretty big deal in the Catholic Church. It's the same kind of investigation that they're currently doing in Ireland into the way the church handled and mishandled the sex abuse crisis. Most nuns only found out about their investigation by reading about it in the papers. When a woman becomes a nun, she commits herself to serving God and serving others. She takes 3 vows which govern her life: poverty, chastity, and obedience. These vows are made to God, but they're through the church. Sister Pat Porra has her own definition of obedience.
I feel obedient towards the God that's within me and also to the people that I work with, that I serve.
And how much obedience do you feel towards the church?
I think it's a patience that I, you know, but the obedience comes from, you know, in hand with patience there.
When Pat entered the convent in the 1960s, she followed a strict routine from sunrise to sunset, and she wore the habit. But then the Second Vatican Council happened, which allowed orders to become much more self-governing. As a result, many nuns chose to move into apartments and went to Mass less frequently. Sister Pat, like many others, decided to swap her habit for street clothes.
We're trying to be a presence in the world, and we can't hide behind a habit. The times have changed. You know, before it was more like semi-monastic. And I remember when I used to work at the hospital when I was a younger sister, and I was in habit. I'd get on the elevator, and here I was a professional, and people would see me and they'd say, oh, isn't she cute? You know, things like that. And those kinds of things put a barrier between you and the people that you're working with, because that's a romanticized vision of what religious life is all about. And that's not what we're all about. You know, I don't want to be up on the pedestal, and I shouldn't be up on the pedestal, and it doesn't help either.
Sister Pat is petite and bird-like, a contrast to her strong political spirit. She started up this Spanish Mass, which is aimed at Hispanic immigrants in Portland, Maine. Latinos are the fastest rising population in Catholic churches, and each Sunday these pews are packed. Rainbow colours from the stained glass windows illuminate the musicians, who are a mix of South American nationalities. When Pat took the veil, she was asked whether or not she wanted to be a teacher or a nurse. Now nuns can be anything from lawyers to lecturers. They are extremely well educated and get involved in changing society. Sister Pat works with immigrants, and she does more than pray for them. She advocates on their behalf, writes letters to congressmen, protests against anti-immigration laws. If someone in Maine gets detained, she gets involved.
Because I know the person, and I've heard that the person is in jail. I write reference letters, work with their lawyers, accompany them to court in Boston, whatever needs to be done.
What are people's reactions to you being a sister?
There are people that think that I shouldn't be. People that think that we're preaching a more socialist role or liberal or whatever, I don't know. But I think that's a gospel mandate. I mean, Christ was very political.
But not all nuns interpret the vows the way that Pat Pora does.
Go right up.
Sister Elizabeth Cobb lives with another nun on a small residential street in Sanford, Maine. She would prefer to live in a convent, but there aren't enough nuns around to enable that. She wakes up before 4 o'clock each morning to pray the traditional Lords in the third bedroom that they've converted into a chapel.
And if you just turn left, where the sun is coming in, is our chapel. This is a picture of our Holy Father, Pope Benedict, and this is our altar. We are blessed by chastity. It gives us so much time to serve others. Poverty is the easiest of the vows. It's simple living. Obedience, I realized what obedience really means. It simply means I give up my own will and live the will of him whom I serve.
90% of American nuns belong to an organization called the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. The Vatican is doing a separate investigation into their doctrines. Sister Elizabeth is part of the remaining 10% who have their own group. She used to be in the same order as Pat Pora, but in the 1990s, their community split. The majority of the sisters want to join a more progressive order. The remaining dozen form their own more conformist group.
We have a special place in the church as religious women. Why would we separate ourselves from Rome? We wanted obedience to the church. Some of the sisters were more avant-garde than we are. Some of them did not choose to be at Mass every day. We wanted to wear the habit because it's identification. And I think today's world, there are people who want to talk with us. And separate from the church, I don't believe that we have a ministry.
My name is Sister Janice Farnham. I'm a member of the Religious of Jesus and Mary.
Janice lives in Arlington, Massachusetts. Her order was questioned in the Apostolic Visitation.
I think those who are in the Vatican always watching, because what happens in the U.S. is probably going to happen in other parts of the church. It just starts here.
The investigation has been conducted in 4 phases. There were meetings with the heads of the 400 religious communities across America. There was a detailed questionnaire, and some of the orders were inspected. American bishops have been asked to donate to the cost of this $1 million investigation. But the very act of being questioned has warned these women.
We all know that visitations come when there are problems. The hierarchy, the Vatican officials, seemingly were still back in the 19th century or even earlier when women religious have moved ahead.
Why do you think the Vatican's concerned about women?
In the Catholic Church, it's not a community of equals. Really, the Catholic Church is a male-dominated, institution.
Part of the intention of the Apostolic Visitation is to try and work out how to increase the number of nuns. Janice entered the convent in the 1950s. This was the boom time, with 180,000 sisters across America. Now there are just 60,000, and their average age is over 70. Janice is 72, but she's not concerned about the trickle of new recruits. She thinks that her generation was unusual, a result of the horrors of the Second World War.
When times are bad, what happens is people begin to reflect again on the values and the meaning of life in general. Bad times are good for religion, and good times are bad for religion.
Millions of Americans have homelands overseas that call to them with different value systems. This questioning by the Vatican is similar to the questioning that Janice has done herself over the decades into her own vocation.
I fell in love a couple of times and I had to question, really and truly, is this what I'm called to do? And then during the years of the civil rights marches and the anti-war demonstrations with the 60s, which is really, I would say, when I came of age spiritually, I did feel at certain times perhaps I would have greater freedom if I left the congregation. Now, why am I here? Because I know that I cannot be Janice Farnham if I'm not a religious of Jesus and Mary. It's that simple. And obviously I'm very moved when I say it, that somehow my personal calling is wrapped up in being a part of this particular congregation, which is very limited, is far from perfect, has many problems, is diminishing quickly. But none of that matters. This is who I am, and I can be no other.
For Salt Radio, I'm Emma Wetherill.
Coming up, a women's movement leader on the American double standard for men and women. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1217. Let's talk politics, or politics as seen through media reporting anyway. In the presidential campaign, did you hear many commentators discuss the president's hair or Mitt Romney's weight? Now think back to the 2008 campaign. With Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin in the race, it was all about clothes, style, who was hot and who was not. Kim Gandy, vice president at the Feminist Majority Foundation and former president of NOW, the National Organization for Women, spoke with me about that glaring difference and how she became a feminist.
I had started at the phone company as a new employee. I was a statistician, and when I was filling out my employee paperwork, there was a plan called Employee Stock Option Plan. It was like a 401k where you put in 3% of your income and they match it with 3%, and the whole 6% goes into AT&T stock for your retirement. And I thought, oh, free money. So I signed up for it. I got to the bottom and it said, if a married woman, husband must sign here. So I asked my boss what that was about, and he said, oh, that's just the Lord and Master law. That means that because your husband owns your paycheck, we have to have his permission to take out that 3% and put it towards AT&T stock. And that was my first introduction to what was, turns out it wasn't the Lord and Master law, it was the head and master law, but it did in fact do exactly what he said it did. Discrimination against women today is a lot more undercover than it was when I was coming into the workforce. And sometimes it doesn't start until a little later. In a number of fields, women coming out of college, for example, earn fairly similar wages to their male cohorts who graduated at the same time. However, the pay gap starts almost right away. Within a year or two after college, there starts to be a significant pay gap, and it continues to widen throughout their careers. For women without college degrees, the pay gap starts much earlier.
As the president of the National Organization for Women, I'm sure you were aware that for some reason, just the label feminist turned some people off. And yet it would seem that most people would support equal pay for equal work, equal rights for everyone. What was the issue? What continues to be the issue?
People in general, it's not just the younger generation, people don't like to be labeled. And the right wing over the last 25 or 30 years has done a very good job of besmirching what were once perfectly good labels, like liberal and feminist, and have made them into words that people don't want to be identified with, even though they support all of the goals. And that's because feminist has been made out by some people who unfortunately have a lot of airtime into being an image of the hairy, humorless harridan.
What impact did Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign have on women's perception of how they're treated?
Oh, it was a real eye-opener for a lot of women to see that Hillary Clinton was treated in such an outrageous and sexist manner. The idea that there would be commentators on mainstream television saying, when I see Barack Obama, I think take off for the future. And when I see Hillary Clinton, I see take out the garbage. And that's exactly how he said it. And commentators like Tucker Carlson saying, every time I see Hillary Clinton, it makes me involuntarily cross my legs. Whoa, really? Is that okay in this day and age to say about women? Showed us that we have a little farther to go than some people thought.
And Sarah Palin also highlighted many of the same issues, didn't she?
Oh, there's no question. There was an enormous focus on Sarah Palin's appearance, on her clothing, on her family, in the same way that men don't receive that kind of examination.
What does the women's movement look like among the young women today?
The women's movement is very multi-generational, multi-racial, multi-issue, much broader than it was in the 1970s and incorporates so many more people than it did in the 1970s. I look at, for instance, the Feminist Majority Leadership Alliances, which are the campus organizations that affiliate with the feminist majority. Over almost 600 campuses, Planned Parenthood has their Vox chapters on close to that number of campuses. The National Organization for Women has their CANs, their Campus Action Networks. Very, very broad representation on college campuses. And anybody who thinks that this generation does not care about equality is not paying attention.
The bottom line seems to be the objectification of women, seeing women as less than. And if you can address that, you've addressed all kinds of issues: domestic violence, violence against women, inequalities in the workplace, inequality in federal policy. What's it going to take to make a difference? Is the answer we have to have a woman president before attitudes change?
I don't even think having a woman president is the answer. There have been women prime ministers in other countries, and frankly, it made some difference in the treatment of women, but it didn't make people all of a sudden say, oh, there's a woman president. Now it's okay for us to have a woman CEO or senior partner. It's going to be gradual, but the law is a leading edge in this. When we change the laws, it does force changes in behavior. And once those changes happen, then people start to come along. Once companies were forced to hire women by the Equal Employment Laws in 1972, a lot of stereotypes about women started to go out the window. But that didn't begin to happen until the law required it. So sometimes we have to force change, and then the understanding follows.
Kim Gandy is Vice President and General Counsel at the Feminist Majority Foundation and former president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. And finally, Carla Goldstein looks at how rigid stereotypes begin and imagines a future without them.
In response to a recent women's forum where violence and trauma emerged as a central theme, a man in the audience said to me that he really identified with the fear and struggle expressed by the speakers. He said he felt terrified by violent men and by war, and that he has been deeply hurt by how narrowly and aggressively masculinity is defined. Having children of my own, I know that nature definitely plays a part in the differences between the genders. My girls' toys were promptly turned into bats, balls, guns, and poking sticks by their male friends. And I watched, in feminist wonder, as my girls and their female friends sat happily and quietly together for hours playing games, arts and crafts, and cooking. Yet despite the gender differences I experienced, the same boys who played shoot 'em up with my girls' dolls also enjoyed spending idle time playing dress-up, making clay figurines, or role-playing with dolls. And I watched the same girls take on science kits, video games, and sports with great interest and zeal. My heart leaps when I watch my daughter's varsity volleyball team playing fiercely, strategically, and strongly as they pursue victory. And when they score and come together in a circle to pat each other's backs, do a cheer, and swing their ponytails in rhythm, I think to myself, both ends of the gender spectrum are possible for all of us. Girls can be soft and strong, and so can boys. If there is human potential to access all 360 degrees of what we consider masculine and feminine qualities, then we can nurture our girls and boys towards a greater balance of both. With so many challenges facing humanity, bringing our full selves to the table requires a renewed and vigorous effort to change how we raise our children and how we develop ourselves as lifelong learners. We need to stop sequestering the empathic impulse to care for others solely within girls and women and plant those seeds firmly in the consciousness of boys and men. And we need to end the assumption that our leadership roles will be filled primarily by boys and men, and instead encourage, teach, and make way for girls and women to step up as leaders in every aspect of life. There is good news for our task on several fronts. On the scientific horizon, new data shows that human neuroplasticity gives us more capacity to change and heal ourselves. Things are not as fixed as we used to believe. And while there's still debate about whether differences between the genders are inherently biological or socially created or both, there are now institutes and programs dedicated to teaching people about gender intelligence and the need to recognize and value the differences between the genders. There's also a slew of research about the strong leadership capacities women have that help improve performance, enhance relationships, and elevate outcomes for the overall community. And in a wonderful new national initiative, A Call to Men, founded by Tony Porter, boys and men are being supported in taking responsibility for changing cultural norms. The organization is working with a wide range of people, from the United Nations to the NFL, to create a new definition of manhood that will support a world that is safe for everybody. The dramatic changes we have seen throughout history hold out the promise that the human trajectory is moving towards a more healed and whole way of living together. And we each have a vitally important role to play in its unfolding.
Carla Goldstein is director of the Omega Women's Leadership Center. Find out more at eomega.org. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.